the message that information is physical has provided a kind of challenge and opportunity to the computer science community. So we need to rethink our basic, those of us who get interested in this, to rethink many of our basic notions and concepts. And I hope that the second part of the title we'll get to by the end of the talk. Again, I'm a computer scientist, mainly having worked in the semantics and logic side of theoretical computer science. And there are some computer science motivations for the work I'm going to describe, but perhaps I won't emphasize that too much in this audience, but rather say that the work, which is joint work with Bob Cooker, who will also be talking later this week, has led to something which I hope is anyway perhaps of more general interest, in that we have an approach to what we've done in developing what one can call, using computer science kind of language, a high-level approach to quantum computation and information. That's what that's led to, is a novel kind of axiomatization of the mathematical structure of quantum mechanics itself, which, well, I sometimes call abstract quantum mechanics, although abstract is a word which doesn't sound good to everyone. But conceptual, maybe. The key point I would like to emphasize, and I hope will come through in the talk, is that it leads to some tools which allow the analysis of quantum information flows through, based on entanglement, to be developed in a particularly perspective, in a particularly perspicuous fashion. Some of the underlying mathematics uses the language of category theory and so on. There won't be too much of that in this talk. And the good news is that a lot of it can be cast in a quite pleasing diagrammatic form. So we'll see some nice pictures later on. Okay, well, let me begin with the classic example of teleportation. So we can say that starting off with Einstein, Podolsky, Rosen, there's the idea of a paradox, of something to show the limitations of quantum mechanics. Then we get a theorem, Bell's theorem, showing that from entanglement we can sort of prove a separation between quantum mechanics and certain kinds of local realistic theories. And then eventually, when the informatic point of view is taken on quantum systems, it turns into a feature. And of course, one of the sort of great axioms of computer science is it isn't a bug, it's a feature. So teleportation is the beginnings of making making a computational resource out of entanglement. So let me just go through this to establish the kind of notation I'll use and so on. I'm sure it's very familiar to all. So Alice wants to send an unknown qubit, as one says, to Bob. Alice and Bob share each a half of an entangled pair, a Bell pair. Alice performs a measurement in a certain cleverly chosen basis, the Bell basis, on the input qubit, the unknown qubit, and her half of the entangled pair. There are four possible outcomes we're dealing with two qubits. So with two classical bits of information, Alice, by classical communication, can tell Bob which of the outcomes of the experiment happened. Bob can then, depending on that information, perform a certain unitary correction, at the end of which, lo and behold, his qubit is exactly what the original input qubit was. So, without the classical communication, Bob doesn't gain an increase of information. But on the other hand, it certainly can't just be the two bits of classical information that perform this marvelous task of transmitting the qubit. So there is, in some sense, a quantum information flow happening through this sharing of the entangled pair. And it's that quantum information flow that we want to get a handle on. So the question is, where does this come from, and how can we see it in a mathematically perspicuous form? And of course, we know that that using a tensor product to describe compound systems immediately means that we're not just dealing with localizable subsystems. But the key positive observation to make is that, in fact, there's a correspondence, a key part of the mathematical structure here, between states in general, which may be entangled states of a tensor product system, and linear maps going from one of the systems to the other. Well, there's not a new observation, it's a well-known observation. The point is, it's an important and relevant observation for understanding entanglement. So, and this just follows from the isomorphism which holds in finite dimensions between the tensor product of the two systems and the space of linear maps from one system to the other. Now, actually, if one's being mathematically careful here, one wants to have basis independent, and as some of you learned a couple of days ago, that means natural isomorphism between the two things. I should really put a star or perhaps a complex conjugation of some kind on the H1 in order to make this correspondence a really nice one. But I'll gloss over this point for the time being, and indeed work at the level of numbers and bases as one usually does. So how does one view entangled states as linear maps? Well, just from a dimensional argument, we know that if given bases for H1 and H2, we get a basis for the tensor product system by taking the Cartesian product of the bases, and therefore a general element of the tensor product will be some linear combination of these basis elements, and they're exactly the right number of coefficients there, so we're in a bijective correspondence with an M by N matrix, which determines a linear map from one system to the other. So it's rather obvious in those terms that this correspondence holds. And the case of the pure tensor is the very special case where if we choose the basis right, we're simply with a single basis element. Okay, before I continue, let me just fix some notation for projectors, which you should keep in mind because we'll be using it in what follows. So just think about the simple case of projector onto a one-dimensional subspace. This will, of course, be spanned by a vector. If we normalize the vectors, then the corresponding projector is essentially just the constant map, which sends any vector, the constant partial map, I should say, which sends any vector which isn't sort of orthogonal to the vector that we're projecting on, to the constant value of that chosen vector spanning the one-dimensional subspace. And the fact that, and of course, such projectors are used to give the branches of at least a projective non-degenerate measurements, and also to give preparations. So these are basic tools of quantum mechanics, and usually taken as very primitive items of quantum mechanics. One of the interesting points in what we'll see is that we'll end up with a quite non-trivial decomposition of these projectors. They actually turn out to have a lot of internal mathematical structure, which one can really use effectively to understand these information flows of entangled systems rather well. Okay, but that's just a little notation there, peep psi. And now let's come back to this idea of the particular case of bipartite systems, systems written as tensor products of two systems, here just two qubit systems. And of course, we know perfectly well that, for example, coming back to the bijection, the isomorphism we were referring to earlier, between linear maps and elements of the tensor product. So we know perfectly well that, for example, entangled states, for example, the Bell state, in that bijective correspondence, of course, corresponds exactly to the identity map from one of the subsystems to the other. This holds, in any finite dimension. So the Bell states are labeled by the corresponding function, which is the identity map. So that already tells us they're very canonical, in some sense logical, entities. They're not random vectors that we happen to pick up in some calculation. So that's one point. Preparation, the original entangled pair that Alice and Bob shared, is already one of these projectors labeled by this particular function. And then the measurement that we perform, that Alice performs, is going to have four outcomes, as we said earlier. And those four outcomes all live in this tensor product space. Therefore, they're all labeled by maps. But it's a completely general observation. Every element of the tensor product is labeled by a map. Now, for each of those maps, there will be a corresponding projector labeled by a vector sitting in the tensor product space, therefore labeled by a linear map. So each of the branches is a projector labeled by a linear map. For example, the Bell state itself, say again, corresponds to the projector labeled by the identity map. Okay, so at the moment, this is just, we've got this one-one correspondence, it may not mean anything. The question we want to ask is, does it mean something? Is there some way we can use this labeling of these projectors by linear maps to give us some useful information about the information flow through the system? And the key question, if you have functions, is can you compose them coherently? So let's see. Okay, so let me show you the following system. We have an awesome array of talent in this field assembled here, so let's see how we can understand this simple system, which is just a little network of projectors, bipartite projectors, onto one-dimensional subspaces of these tensor product spaces. So what you see, so I've written it diagrammatically, and there's an explicit expression here, just so we're clear. The information is time, if you like, is flowing upwards in this diagram. So we're going from a tensor product of three Hilbert spaces back to the same tensor product of three Hilbert spaces. And we pass firstly through the identity in the first component and a projector labeled by the linear map F1 in the second and third components. Okay, so we have to remember this labeling. Then we pass through a projector labeled by F2, going, say, from H1 to H2 in the first and second components, and the identity in the third component, and so on. So we pass through all these four boxes. Okay? So these might arise as projector, as preparations, or as branches of measurements in some protocol that we set up, of which, as we saw, teleportation is a basic example. So the question is, quite simply, what can we say about the total information flow through this system? And can we use this labeling by functions to tell us something informative about it? So in particular, in some sense, I'd like to express the output on the third component, H3 of the output, in some relationship to the input on the first component. So, does anyone have an answer to this? In principle, it should be something that we can take our matrices out and multiply them. But is there anything we can say? Okay, so I hear no answer, so I'll continue. So it turns out that the answer we can give is this. So you'll agree with two things. Firstly, it is a rather clear-cut answer to the question. And secondly, you may well wonder, well, what is this madness? What the hell is going on here? What it's saying seems to bear no relation. So what it's saying is we're applying firstly the function F2 itself. This is the function now, no longer the projector. These before were projectors, just these constant maps mapping down onto vectors in the tensor product space. But the expression we have here now is the composition of those actual functions. But it seems to be in a crazy order that's completely unrelated to the physical order of the flow through the system. Notice that the first thing we hit is not F1, which is the first box that appears in time order, but F2. Then we hit F1, so apparently going, so to speak, backwards in time. Then we hit F3, but now we hit F3 not itself, but the adjoint of F3. So dagger means adjoint. So it's going in the opposite direction. Then we hit F2 again, but now it's adjoint, not the map itself. Then we hit F4, then we hit F3, and then we come out. Seems barking mad, doesn't it? But you can actually do the math, as they say, and it works. But of course, we don't just want to crunch some matrices. We want to understand what's going on, just as I'm suggesting we would like to understand systematically what goes on in teleportation protocol and many other similar things. So we can do a simple thing that makes this, that is the first step, the key step towards making all this clear, and that is that we can draw a line. If we draw this line, then we can so modulo the question what on earth this line means, from drawing that line, we can read off the answer that we just gave. Because if you follow this line from the input, you see that indeed we first encounter F2, we go across from its input side to its output side, and we bounce back and hit F1, and go across through F1, then coming up, we come up to F3, but on its output side, and we have to flow back to its input side, hence we take the adjoint. And so we continue bouncing around our little maze until eventually we emerge, and what we read off along the way is exactly this composition of functions we just described. So the line tells us the answer, and now we're left only with the question of what does the line mean. But before we answer that question, let's see how we can use this kind of analysis to look again at teleportation and a whole family of similar protocols. So let's come back to teleportation. The two basic things are, firstly, we prepare the Bell state, that's one projector, labeled by the identity. And now we take just the case, the sort of favorable case, where we don't have to do any correction really, where the branch through the measurement is actually the one itself labeled by the Bell state. So that's also labeled by the identity. So in physical time, we firstly prepare the shared entangled state, then we perform the measurement. But what actually happens in our information flow following the line is that we flow up along the identity, then back along the identity again, and then out. And of course, if we compose the functions, we get the identity composed with the identity, and indeed the input is transmitted unchanged to the output. So that's the basic case of teleportation. And in fact, the general case where we do need to make a correction can be analyzed in exactly the same terms. And moreover, we can now systematically see the relation between the measurement and the correction that we perform. Because for a given branch of the measurement, which is going to be some state, some bipartite state, therefore it will be labeled by some map beta I. And then clearly, following this information flow through, the correction we need to perform exactly has to be the inverse of the function labeling that branch of the measurement. Because that exactly is the thing which will cancel out as we compose the functions following the information flow, again to give us the identity, which means that the input from Alice is transmitted through to Bob. So this analysis tells us what the logical nature of the Bell basis and the corresponding corrections has to be. They are just a labeling by functions of the measurement, and the corresponding unitary has to be the inverse. And now we can go to logic gate teleportation. We're transmitting not the qubit or the system, however many qubits it is, but a function of the qubit. And again, the same kind of analysis tells us that for now we're having a preparation which is not labeled by the identity, but in general by some map F. And we're going to need to have a branch of a measurement and the corresponding correction satisfying exactly this functional equation. So that, so to speak, is the logic of logic gate teleportation. Okay, so another example of the same analysis of information flow. And as a final variation, entanglement swapping. We start off with entanglements between A and B and C and D, both given by preparations, and then performing this kind of measurement branch again, we see exactly that we swap the entanglements, so we end up now with A entangled with D and B entangled with C. And moreover, we can read off the information flow again to see that the entanglement, for example, between A and D is linked by the identity map again, so again we have a Bell pair. Okay, so if we can figure out what these lines mean, it seems we're in shape to do some good analysis of this kind of entanglement-based information flow. Yes, I can't see where the questioner is. Well, so now I'm going to talk about the logic of lines. The point is, what can we do with this kind of picture and what can't we do? So here these are things that I am claiming to do, and so were all the others. So let's look more generally. Indeed, it's true that there's a kind of logic of lines here. There's some kind of method to this madness, and eventually we'll see if there's mathematics to this madness. But let's see the method. The point is, the information flows that are permitted are never through the box. They're across either the bottom half of the box or the top half of the box. So it's as if there's a brick wall in the middle and no information can propagate through, but information can propagate across in either direction. Remembering that a projection is a constant map, that's a pretty good hint that there isn't going to be any information flow through, because the point about a constant map is that it's independent of the input. But as I say, this will become completely clear when we decompose the projectors into finer elements. For now, we're just looking at sort of just describing what we've been doing. So all these kind of flows below are forbidden, and everything we did was in terms of the four kinds of flows that you see there. Of course, if we're taking the map, the labeling map as going from the left-hand port to the right-hand port, then wherever we go from right to left, we take the adjoint map instead. Okay. Now, if we're trying to understand what the mathematical structure is that allows this kind of manipulation, of course, it's helpful to have another example. And in fact, and I think this is quite related to issue of toy models and other things, but it's also related to things that have been around in computing for a long time. In fact, we can see sets and relations as a kind of discrete version which carries an awful lot of the same structure as quantum mechanics. This is where we replace Hilbert spaces by sets. Sounds bad, but now not so bad when we replace linear maps by relations, which after all we can think of as Boolean-valued matrices, and tensor products by Cartesian products. In fact, we can make sense of exactly the same kind of diagrams in that setting, where now the corresponding notion of a projector, so we have a relation R, and indeed you can think of a relation as establishing a correlation between the different components of the tuple that it's a relation on. And this is something which, after all, database theorists have been studying for many decades. You look at a compound system, meaning an n-tuple relation, a big table in a database, and you're interested, for example, in functional dependency. So that given that you know something about one component, you know certain information about other components as well. I'm not saying you can actually do quantum mechanics with relations, but much of the structure is applicable, and what stops you doing full quantum mechanics is, so to speak, the poverty of the Booleans as compared with the complex numbers. But anyway. Let's just see the formal thing here, which is, given a relation between x and y, we make a bipartite projector of it, which is a relation from x cross x to x cross s, or x or whatever it is, by simply taking the Cartesian square of the relation twice. Now you see, when you have a Cartesian product, you're saying there's no correlation, but a full Cartesian product, you're saying there's no correlation between pairs between first components and second components. Because any two elements in the first component are related to the same things in the second, namely everything. So a full Cartesian square is a way of saying no correlation, no information flow. On the other hand, there is information flow across, namely exactly the information flow that you have expressed in the relation R, which might, for example, be a function, as we have F1 and F2 here, which are particular cases of relations. And in fact, if you just kind of do the computation with these definitions, so if you start off with a function f1 and a function f2, take the projector, which is this full Cartesian square of its graph, and do the compositions in the same kind of way as we were doing before, you see that the flow through the system is exactly the composition of these functions. And intuitively, what's happening is you have triples now, three inputs, three outputs, triples. And when you pass through the first box, what it does is to impose the correlation, an F2 relationship between the second and third components of the triple. And when you pass through the second box, the one labeled with F1, it imposes an F1 relationship between the first and second components of the triple. It will therefore follow that by the end, the third component of the triple must be in a relationship of the composition of the functions F2 with F1 with the first component of what the triple was originally. That's why we get this result. But this is a simple computation, just a bit discrete math. And in fact, this works for arbitrary relations, of course, not just for functions. Okay, so how can we express this in general terms and see what's going on? So the setting we take is category theory. And I don't want to belabor this. Some people hopefully may have gone to some of the tutorial talks. But in any event, what's going to be important for us is that we have types. I'll come back to that in a moment. We describe processes by typed arrows, which can be composed. And this paradigm has proved very fruitful in logic and in computer science, where we think of, for example, of the objects as data types and the processes as programs of some kind. For us, the types would be types of system, essentially the labels of which kind of Hilbert space we're in, if you like, and the arrows will be processes, which could be unitary evolutions and measurements and so on. And to express compound systems, we have what are known as symmetric monoidal categories. So we have the abstract notion of a tensor product, which lets us put types together to express the types of compound systems, and also to put processes together. This is just the standard idea of the tensor product of two maps, but done generally. And there are this structure that lets us say that there's a symmetry, so it has some rules. In fact, this is a natural transformation for those who come through some feeling for what natural transformations are. So this is a very well-known and well-studied kind of structure, which in fact is showing up increasingly, not so much in pure quantum information, quantum mechanics world, but in world of topological quantum field theories and such things. Okay, so, and this carries with it some degree of logic as well, and those who went to the tutorial talk, my tutorial talk yesterday, would have seen something about this. The point about a tensor product is that it's not a product. In particular, it does not have diagonals and it does not have projections. And obviously that gives us, that means that we can apply this meaningfully to a situation where we don't have cloning and we don't have deleting. So this is the basic setting in which we can work, in which we can define things in such a way that all these manipulations get a strict meaning and we can do calculations at a high level of generality which directly apply to these kind of situations. Now, the further kind of structure that we need in order to get right to grips with this idea of information flow and entanglement is, again, something that's been around for a while and is widely used. I'm not going to quite go into all the details, but the main part of it is here, is the idea of a compact closed category. So we have an idea of duality, that's important, and we have the very important idea of a unit and a co-unit. So the unit is the name of the identity, so to speak, and it, in effect, it's directly an abstraction of the idea of a Bell pair. It's the name of the identity, and as we saw, it's in some sense the Bell state itself is the thing that corresponds to the identity map. And there's a dual notion of a co-unit, which is like a product evaluation. But these are abstract things, and they're subject just to two very simple classical algebraic identities. But you see, if we read the, which have sort of very nice roots in mathematics and very natural from that point of view, but I won't belabor that point. The thing I want to say is that if you take this first triangular identity, we can relate it rather directly to teleportation. Think of the left-hand A as our input qubit. Now, we leave that alone, but we put next to it now exactly a Bell pair. That's what this eta A does. It creates a Bell pair. And then the co-unit does the measurement, so to speak, on the branch where we're going to label by the Bell state, on the input qubit and Alice's half of the entangled pair. And then we're just left with one copy of A. We think of that as a destructive measurement. And what this law tells us is that that whole thing equates to the identity map. So that's saying going through that branch exactly gives us the identity. So, of course, this is a much more general equation, which sort of has a lot of mathematical motivation of a much more general kind. But the point is, it's very close to these notions, you know, for teleportation. We can apply it rather directly. So there are examples, of course, this kind of structure, and in particular, the salient ones from this point of view are Hilbert spaces, and also finite dimensional Hilbert spaces, I should say, and also, as we saw, this is a parallel running example of sets and relations. The sets and relations, so you have the one element set is the unit, and is the identity for the tensor product, the Cartesian product here, and what the unit is just the thing that lays out the diagonal relation as the set of pairs on the diagonal related to the single element in this one-point set, and the co-unit is just the converse. In finite dimensional vector spaces, we get this kind of representation of the identity in the tensor product. So the identity for the unit for the tensor product is just the ground field, the field of complex numbers, and we simply have the thing that gives us the unit, which you see is essentially the Bell state, is the thing, since it's a linear map from the complex numbers, it's determined by what it does on one, and it sends one exactly to this diagonal pairing between some basis and then the conjugate basis in the dual space. And the co-unit is the evaluation. Now, in generality, if we have this kind of structure, we get a whole duality that works on morphisms as well. So given an F going from A to B, we can define an F star going from B star to A star. And even more importantly from our point of view, we have not just the representation of the identity, but the representation of an arbitrary map, which we call the name of the map. So we can go from a map going from A to B, to this name, which goes from the unit of the tensor into A star tensor B. And you see this is simply a composite of the sort of the general unit, the thing corresponding to the identity, with the map F itself applied in the appropriate component. And there's a dual notion of a coname. The point is that the name will be the essential element of creating entangled states as representations of linear maps, and the coname will be exactly the way that we label branches of a measurement with some given linear map. So it gives us an abstract language for doing those things. And again, in generality, we get isomorphisms between the space of all arrows from A to B and the space of elements of the tensor product A star B. That's the name is giving us this isomorphism. And there's also an isomorphism with the conames. But in particular, if we focus on the isomorphism between maps, arrows, I should say, and names, then this is exactly the correspondence we were using in the concrete case before between linear maps on the one hand and elements of the tensor product on the other. So this is the abstract and general version. And all the structure we need to do the manipulations we were doing are going to work at this general level, of course. So with these kind of tools, we can come back to the issue of mathematical foundations of quantum mechanics, which have been lying there in their pristine beauty, somewhat undisturbed. The von Neumann formalism. And we can actually make some observations. And one observation I would make is that there's a sense in which when we come to look at quantum information protocols, the von Neumann style of formalism does not really do the whole job for us. And what I have in mind is the fact that interesting protocols typically involve a combination of purely quantum operations and classical communication. What happens is one does some calculation in the von Neumann formalism, then one says something in another step of the protocol about some classical communication, typically in English, and then continues, and of course there's some mathematics, but the formalism itself does not give a consistent description of the whole thing. Now that may not seem like a big deal, but our experience in computer science is that protocols are pretty hard to understand, they get more complex, and in the end it is good to be able to capture the whole thing formally. And there's also a foundationally interesting point: how can we combine consistently in a single formalism the description of the purely quantum part and the classical information part, the branching on the outcomes of measurements, and the fact that depending on which measurement outcome we got, we should do one unitary correction or another, for example. And one of the basic reasons the von Neumann formalism doesn't capture this well is that there are no types, or really there's only one type, the ambient Hilbert space, and all operators simply take that type as a domain and return it as their codomain. If we go to this kind of picture with categories and so on, then we have types, and we can express a richer range of possibilities. In particular, we've already seen the tensor product. If we also introduce another type, which is, so to speak, the abstract version of the direct sum, in much the same way as the tensor product in the abstract sense of a monoidal category is a generalization from tensor product of Hilbert spaces. So if we have this direct sum, we can use that to represent branching, the branching that you get on outcomes from measurement. So we can express the type of a measurement in these terms, which is essentially, if you like, an abstract form of a spectral decomposition or something of that kind. And using that, we can express the dependency of what we do later, for example, performing a unitary correction, which is fundamental in these kind of protocols in measurement-based computing and so on which outcome we had for a previous measurement. So you see here, for example, we do this measurement M, we branch into these distinct outcomes, the AIs, and then we perform the appropriate UI depending on which of those outcomes we actually got. So that's one point. The second point is that the idea of classical in communication itself can be represented rather elegantly at an abstract level here, just in terms of the distributivity of the tensor product over this abstract direct sum. So if you think here we have some system A tensor B, so in the location A where Alice is, she performs some measurement, and we get some branching into outcomes A1 and A2, then the propagation of which, so at that point, so to speak, Alice knows which branch she's in and can do one operation or another depending on which of those branches she's in, but Bob doesn't. But by applying distributivity, we spread this information outwards, Now, indeed, we could apply something in the second component of the tensor product, which is, say, some U1, if we're in the first branch of this direct sum on the right, and some different operation U2 if we're in the second branch. So in that way, we can get a complete description of the protocol. So here is teleportation from this point of view. And we get it as a composition of these typed processes, where each step has a clear correspondence with the usual description. But now the whole story is there in the single formalism. We start off with the input qubit. As we saw earlier, we represent the preparation of the Bell state by this idea of this unit eta, which creates this entangled pair. We then perform a measurement, which arises by gluing together four maps, the UIs, taking their co-names, and that will collapse the first two qubits into one of four possible outcomes. We then represent the classical information by distributivity, as we just explained. So we spread which branch of the knowledge of which branch of this sum we're in outwards. So now Bob knows which branch we're in. And then depending on the branch we're in, so therefore also a direct sum of operators operating functorially on these maps, we apply the unitary corrections. And what are these unitary corrections? Well, in the ith branch, which arose by applying the coname associated with the ith morphism UI in our measurement, we apply the map, which is the inverse of that, in order to obtain the correction and to get, in the end, the output qubit at Bob's site to be equal to the input qubit at Alice's site. So what you see on the top line is a complete description of the protocol. The fact that it works, the fact that the input qubit is eventually transmitted unchanged to the output, is expressed by the fact that this top line gives us the same thing as chasing around the lower part of the diagram. So in each branch of the measurement outcome, we get the identity. So the specification of the protocol is described by this typed composite arrow in the top line, and its correctness is expressed by the commutativity of this diagram, which one can then prove. Now, I've shown you some commutative diagrams and mentioned some categorical definitions. Now let's switch to using a graphical calculus. How much time do I have left at this point? Oh, good. Doing all right then. Fine. So in fact, the whole thing can be, the mathematics can be cast in a diagrammatic form, which I think is quite attractive. And in particular, we'll see that the key algebraic fact that makes all these, that makes the fact that these protocols work immediately transparent, can be expressed rather nicely in this diagrammatic form. So what we're going to do, and this is sort of itself coming from a rich mathematical tradition, which is of viewing monoidal categories in geometric terms, developed by particular Joual and Street and other people, which again has shown up in sort of fancy topics like topological quantum field theories and categorical ways of expressing topological invariants, such as the Jones polynomial and so on. But we're doing something more modest here, but something which applies rather directly to the quantum information setting. So what we're going to do is to rewrite the unit as a triangle and the co-unit as an upside down triangle. So the sharp end is where we come from nothing, and we just produce this entangled pair. So that's the triangle with its vertex at the bottom. And on the other hand, the co-unit sort of swallows two inputs and they disappear. So it's a branch of a measurement, essentially. They disappear or turn into a number, if you like. Actually, in the main geometrical tradition, people just write bends in the lines. But I think individuating these units and co-units in this way sort of helps to make what's going on a bit more perspicuous. And then we can rewrite these triangular identities, which I was already suggesting to you can be seen as a kind of abstract form of teleportation, just as this very simple and actually rather evident identity of planar diagrams in this style. That if you have a bend that goes up and then a matching bend that goes down, well, grab both ends of this piece of string and pull it out, and you get a straight line. Seems reasonable. And certainly the other one is just the dual one for the downward pointing lines. Okay, so that's how we'll think of the triangular identities. Names and co-names, well, we saw that they were simply composites between the unit for a name, the unit, and the morphism, and for a co-name, the co-unit and the morphism, and that's just a matter of attaching along these lines boxes corresponding to those arrows, to those processes. So a name and a co-name is just a little composite diagram where we've connected a couple of these boxes together. Notice what this does is, whereas F would have had its input continuing to go up through its output upwards, the point of this co-name here is to act as a U-bend and change the flow around back. So remember, we had these strange backwards flows in the boxes we were in the line diagrams we saw earlier. This is the underlying structure from which all of that can be generated. And the name is doing something similar. And now we're going to come to a very interesting point, which is that projectors themselves, which are usually taken as really fundamental building blocks or primitives, can be decomposed in this kind of calculus here. And that from that we'll really understand the information flows. We've seen that very important is this correspondence between arrows and the tensor product. And what we're going to do is to decompose the projector in this star. In fact, let me give the full picture of how a decomposed bipartite projector, namely the thing we were labeling as P sub F before, looks like in this analysis. So you see on the input side, remember this is, in the end, the projector is a constant matter. And of course, when I'm making these statements, what you should bear in mind is that if we interpret everything in Hilbert spaces, in the way that I showed you, and just run these definitions through, you get exactly the expected definition. This is the general algebra that's making that whatever happens works. So if you look at the whole projector, it was essentially a constant map. And indeed, what happens is that you get these two halves, which don't really communicate with each other. You get the co-name at the bottom end and the name at the top end. And the interesting information flows are indeed across rather than through. So these are the kinds of lines that we saw. And in the case that we wanted to go the other way, we could take the adjoint of the map. I haven't explained adjoints, but suffice it to say that they make good sense in this general setting. So given that we have this decomposition of projectors, we can now come back to the basic lemma here that makes all the manipulations we saw earlier work and explains how we can calculate in a routine way what the information flow through such a system is. And it's this simple compositionality property. You see, here we have what you can think of as a preparation in yellow below and a branch of a measurement above. And we indeed want to see that what goes on is not that we go in time order, thinking of information flowing up, but rather information flow order, where we run firstly through the a co-name and then back through the name and eventually out. And the total information flow is the composition of the maps that we encounter along the way. This was exactly the basic piece that we had that giving us our analysis of the examples that we looked at earlier. So the compositionality lemma is that this is true, and from this you can then apply it piece by piece to a large network and get this kind of analysis. So why is it true? Well, actually, there's a very simple diagrammatic proof, which is a nice illustration of these diagrammatic methods. Given this situation, take the F box and just pull it down, because after all, the pieces of string are elastic. That's, by the way, what naturality and functoriality are about here. They're saying these pieces of string are elastic and you can slide the boxes up and down. So pull the F box down, pull the G box up, and what you're left with now is an instance of the triangle identity in the middle. It cancels and you're just left with the composition of the G and the F. Okay, and that's it. And from that we get, for example, teleportation, the analysis that we saw earlier, that the net information flow, that we go through the ith branch of the measurement and then perform the corresponding ith unitary correction, which is labeled with the inverse of the function labeling, the arrow labeling the ith branch of the measurement, will just be the composite of beta I and its inverse, which cancels out to give us the identity. So that's the nub of the general proof. So we can go on from here and set up a whole the setting at this abstract level is rich enough to account for all the things listed here. compound systems, unitaries, projectors, as we've seen, preparations of entangled states, the Bra-Ket notation, including things like Ket bras and so on, of course. There's a whole calculus of traces at this abstract level. Surprisingly, although it all looks very qualitative, there's a good theory of scalars, and the quantitative aspect of the theory comes out as well. There's a Born rule, Hilbert Schmidt norm, which was referred to earlier, appears in a very conceptual way, and so on. We can give a dictionary of proper mechanical concepts in this abstract setting. And in fact, as has recently been a nice paper by Peter Selinger, which has shown a very convincing way how this setting can elegantly accommodate the standard quantum information setting of completely positive maps acting on density operators. And in fact, very nicely, there's a general construction which can be performed at the abstract level, which is a general form of the idea of a systematic way of going from the setting of linear maps on Hilbert space to completely positive maps on density operators. So things look very nice in that way as well. And to finish up by sort of justifying the second half of my title, I don't have time to go into this in detail, but just to say that the graphical calculus that I showed you, firstly, it's linked to various developments in geometry. And an interesting point, by the way, is that the symmetry that I mentioned as part of the monoidal structure I was assuming is not, strictly speaking, needed for most of what one seems to do in quantum information. I think it's an interesting question of how much of quantum information, so to speak, lives in the plane and how much needs more than that. And for example, there's a nice representation of Temporally-Leave algebras in this setting. From the logical point of view, the diagrammatic calculus can be seen as a calculus of proofs for a certain logic. Those who went to the talk yesterday about logics as type theories for quantum processes will have some of the flavor of that. The idea of simplification of diagrams, kind of pulling things out straight and so on, corresponds to normalization or cut elimination of proofs. And Ross Duncan is giving a poster on this meeting, and has been working on that. So that's, in that sense, I justify the second part of my title, that while as computer scientists we have to acknowledge that information is physical, I think we have some basis for responding that there's also an interesting logical structure to physics, to the relevant physics for quantum information, which I think can be of interest to both communities. So I'll just put up some references and stop there. Thanks.